Welcome back, party people, to the Hemingway List Party, the party playlist of Hemingway classics. Today we're talking about chapter 29 of part 7. Starting to feel like a psychotic episode, maybe. And Anna has grown rather paranoid about those around her. Soma Stars says, she's in the thick of it now, I read ahead long ago. So, I knew this was coming and why I kept saying she's in the throes of a severe mental illness. It does feel like a psychotic episode. Yes. It does feel a bit like one, doesn't it? It doesn't seem as chaotic and as manic as a psychotic episode typically is. But that could just be the way that Tolstoy is portraying it. But she's certainly got that kind of hyperactive paranoia that sort of precedes a psychotic episode. It's kind of like a schizophrenic schizoactive? Oh mate, I can't remember the word. Anyway, they're all bundled in together. Essentially, you get super paranoid and the bit of your brain that tries to figure everything out goes haywire. And so you start attaching meaning to everything that's going around, everything that's going on, and you kind of spin yourself out. That's why schizophrenic people tend to be, they latch on to symbolism and things like conspiracies and religious theories and these kinds of things. And often when people have a psychotic episode, they do look, the pattern recognition bit of your brain, which is always trying to link things together, goes haywire. And so it's like everything's connected, everything's one big conspiracy, and they think they're making sense out of absolutely everything they see. So, I don't know. Is that what we're seeing here? Maybe the beginnings of something like that. She's certainly getting very jealous and she's not trusting anyone. I wonder, says Soma Stars, what Tolstoy was getting at when he wrote this character. Was psychology even a field at this time? Was mental illness even considered a thing yet? Or was Tolstoy trying to write a morality tale, a cautionary one? Yeah, before it was known as like mental illness, or you know, maybe the word psychology was new or wasn't a thing yet, they still knew what these mental illnesses were to a degree. We still don't really know. Everything's just kind of theoretical, really, because we don't know really how the brain works to such a degree. But back then, they would represent these mental illnesses, various mental illnesses, sort of symbolically. They tried to make sense of them in a symbolic way, if that makes sense. So, for instance, a psychotic episode was referred to as metanoia. Metanoia, which means changing one's mind. Because in a psychotic episode, after a psychotic episode, people become quite almost catatonic, and they slowly rebuild their personality. And it's almost like they build up a new personality in some ways. And slowly, it takes months and months. So if you've ever known someone to have one, and then you meet them afterwards, they're really quite strange. It's really eerie. It's almost like they're not quite there. They're sort of spaced out and a little bit in slow motion. But then they try to almost mimic the way that they were. It's like they're trying to do an impression of themselves being normal. And it's really kind of discomforting to see and to watch. I had a mate who had a psychotic episode. And he was always this cheeky, silly, but very smart guy. And he was just a real, like, he didn't give a shit. Like, he'd just do anything. He was just one of the coolest guys. And but he was also a real trickster. And then after his psychotic episode, he was really strange. But then he would do these mischievous things, but it was forced, And it was just annoying, to be honest. It was like he was like, yeah, I'm kind of like mischievous and a bit cheeky, so I'll do this thing. And he'd do something. I was like, oh man, that's actually really annoying that you just pressed that button, or whatever he did. It was almost like, you know, when you meet someone at a party and that person's trying to establish themselves as like the edgy guy, and they just do all edgy things and try to be like, yeah, I don't even care. I'll just tip over this vase over here, and I'll just like tip it over and be like, yeah, whatever, I'm edgy. And it's like, you're trying too hard to be edgy, and it's coming off across as a bit, I don't know what the word I'm looking for. Conceited, maybe? I don't know. It's coming a bit forced. It was like that for this guy, because his normal personality was to be kind of edgy, but effortlessly edgy. Anyway, I'm going off on tangents here. So metanoia, what they used to call it, change, it means changing your mind, because they would symbolize a psychotic episode before it was called that as your mind cooking itself, like going overactive to the point where it self-destructs essentially and melts down. You have a meltdown. And then you rebuild yourself from there. It's like your personality has to be rebuilt from the ashes of what's left after the episode, after the metanoia. That's the way they explained it before they actually knew what was going on in your brain. Like, I'm sure they knew there wasn't actually fire in your brain, but that was just the way they represented it. And now we've come a long way in what we know, but that representation still actually is pretty good way to metaphorically understand what a psychotic episode is. It's pretty accurate. I think they knew these things. To answer your question about was psychology a field? Was mental illness considered a thing yet? Yeah, it was, but it was just considered a thing through a different set of terminology. Swims to the Mumford, she said, yeah, he based it on a real life incident from his life and the story grew around it. Part 7 needs to come to a conclusion before I bore all of you to pieces about all of this. I suffer the curse of an analytic mind, or as my exasperated loved ones say, why do you have to overthink everything? No, Swim. Don't listen to him. People say that to me too. You're overthinking it. It's such a cop-out, right? You just say, nah, I'm just thinking about it. Like, just my regular amount of thinking. Think on, my friend. Soma Stars says, I look forward to being bored with this info. Yeah, me too. I can't wait. I Am Norwegian said, we've understood psychology for way longer than it has been a field. Sure, we dressed up our understanding of it in symbols and stories, but that doesn't lessen the insight we had. I think trying to look at all of this too clinically is a mistake. You're not going to get anything more out of the story by opening the DSM-5 and trying to figure out where and it ticks the most boxes, are you? I also saying this because I got way more out of the reading Dostoevsky and Jung than I ever did therapy or medication. A diagnosis doesn't really tell you much, especially if you're actively looking for one, because you're not going to find exactly what you're looking for, but maybe blind yourself to everything else. Because you are going to find exactly what you're looking for, but maybe you blind yourself to everything else. And I'm not accusing you of doing this. I'm just sharing my view on the whole mental illness in books thing. Not that I'm above a little armchair psychologizing myself. Ha ha. Soma Stars says, no worries. Answered. Swims to the Mofish. He answered what I was getting at. Sounds like he based it on a real life incident, which makes sense given that he nailed it so well. Yeah. I think he's nailed it to a degree. I think it seems like a real episode, but it's also pretty nondescript. Like, it's hard to know, is she just depressed? Is she just an addict? Is she manic depressive, or bipolar as we now call it? Or is she schizophrenic? Does she have some kind of a personality disorder? It's not that accurate. I don't think. It could be any of those things. And if he was more detailed about her actions and her symptoms, it would be easier to hone in on one of them. But he's kept it pretty vague. So it really could be one of many things. The reason I've taken an interest in this is because the book I just finished writing, the character undergoes a progressively deteriorating state of mind. And they're real diagnosable ailments that my character goes through. I don't want to say what they are because I don't want I don't want to say what they are. I want people to be, like we're doing, be able to discuss it and try to figure out what is happening to this character in my book. But I would say that my one is, you know, a lot more detailed and a lot more accurate to specific symptoms to a specific illness, I would say, or a progression of illnesses. And I actually had interviews with a friend of mine who is the lecturer in psychology at RMIT University. He's a doctor of psychology. And as I wrote the book, I conferred with him on a few occasions to make sure that my portrayals of the illness were accurate. It's a first-person book, so first-person present tense. No, past tense, sorry. But it's first person, so you experience these mental illnesses through the first person lens of the character going through them. And so I needed to be able to put the words of him explaining it as it's happening, and for it to be accurate, which is not easy to do when you're explaining a mental illness that you don't have. So I wanted it to be good. I wanted it to be accurate. That's why I'm interested in it, and that's why I tend to know a lot about these things. Because I'm a bit of an armchair student of it myself. JMama8779 said, yikes, I don't think we'll be seeing Anna for much longer. Yikes. Really? I think she's going to throw herself in front of a train. I think that train death at the start of the book, remember that? Was a bit of a, I don't know, what do they call it? Whatever it's called. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to say foreshadowing because that's not the word I'm meaning. An omen? Oh, who cares? Let's read chapter 30. My brain's not working. There. Again, it is that girl. Again, I understand it all, Anna said to herself as soon as the carriage started and rocking slightly, rattled over the stones, and again different impressions succeeded one after another in her brain. What was the last thing I thought of that was so good? She tried to remember. Tiutkin Kuifur. No, not that. Oh yes, what Yashvin said. The struggle for existence and hatred are the only things that unite people. No, you are going in vain. She mentally addressed a company of people in a caliche with four horses who were evidently going out of town on a spree. And the dog you have with you won't help you. You can't escape from yourselves. Glancing in the direction in which Peter was looking, she saw a workman, nearly dead drunk with his head swaying about, who was being led off somewhere by a policeman. That one is more likely to, she thought. Count Vronsky and I have also been unable to find that pleasure from which we expected so much. And now for the first time, Anna turned the bright light in which she saw everything upon her relations with him, and which she had always avoided thinking. What did he look for in me? Not so much love as the satisfaction of his vanity. She remembered his words, the expression of his face, suggestive of the faithful setter in the early days of their union. Everything now confirmed her view. Yes, there was in him the triumph of successful vanity. Of course there was love, too, but the greater part was pride in his success. He boasted of me. Now that is past. There is nothing to be proud of. Not to be proud, but to be ashamed. He has taken from me all he could, and now he does not need me. He is weary of me and is trying not to act dishonorably toward me. Yesterday he betrayed himself. He wants a divorce and a marriage in order to burn his boats. He loves me, but how? The zest is gone, she said to herself in English. That man wants to astonish everybody and is very well satisfied with himself, she thought, glancing at a rosy-faced shop assistant who was riding a hired horse. No, I have no longer the right flavour for him. I have no longer the right flavour for him. If I go away, he will, at the bottom of his heart, be pleased. That was not a surmise. She saw it clearly in the piercing light which now revealed to her the meaning of life and of human relations. My love grows more and more passionate and egotistic, and his dwindles and dwindles, and that is why we are separating, she went on thinking, and there is no remedy. For me, everything centres on him, and I demand that he should give himself up to me more and more completely, but he wants more and more to get away from me. Before we were united, we really drew together, but now we are irresistibly drifting apart, and it cannot be altered. He tells me I am unreasonably jealous, and I have told myself that I am unreasonably jealous, but it is not true. I am not jealous, but dissatisfied. But, she opened her mouth and changed her place in the carriage from agitation produced by a sudden thought, if I could be anything but his mistress, passionately loving nothing but his caresses, but I cannot and do not want to be anything else. And this desire awakens disgust in him, and that arouses anger in me, and it cannot be otherwise. Don't I know that he would not deceive me, that he has no designs on that Sorokina, that he is not in love with Kitty, and will not be unfaithful to me? I know all that, but that does not make it easier for me. If without loving me he is kind and tender to me from a sense of duty, but what I desire is lacking, that would be 1,000 times worse than anger. It would be hell, and that is just how it is. He has long ceased to love me, and where love ceases, there hate begins. I don't know these streets at all. Here is a hill and houses, and in the houses are people, and more people. There is no end to them, and they all hate one another. Well, supposing I picture to myself what I want in order to be happy. Well, I get divorced, and Alexis Alexandrovich gives me Sirza, and I marry Vronsky. Remembering Karenin, she pictured him to herself with extraordinary vividness, as if he stood before her with his mild, dull, lifeless eyes, the blue veins of his white hands, his intonations, his cracking fingers, and remembering the feeling that had once existed between them and which had also been called love, she shuddered with revulsion. Well, I get divorced and become Vronsky's wife. What then? Will Kitty cease looking at me as she did this afternoon? No. Will Sirza stop asking and wondering about my two husbands? And between Vronsky and myself, what new feeling can I invent? Is any kind, not of happiness even, but of absence of torture, possible? No. She now answered herself without the least hesitation. It is impossible. Life is sundering us, and I am the cause of his unhappiness, and he is of mine. And neither he nor I can be made different. Every effort has been made, but the screws have given way. A beggar woman with a baby. She thinks I pity her. Are we not all flung into the world only to hate each other and therefore to torment ourselves and others? There go schoolboys. They are laughing. Sirza? She remembered. I thought I loved him too and was touched at my own tenderness for him, yet I lived without him and exchanged his love for another's and did not complain of the change as long as the other love satisfied me. And she thought with disgust of what she called the other love. The clearness with which she now saw her own and everyone else's life pleased her. It's the same with me, and Peter and Theodore, the coachman, and with the tradesman, and with all the people that live away there by the Volga, where those advertisements invite one to go, and everywhere and always. She thought as she drove up to the low building of the Nidzi station, where the porters ran out to meet her. Shall I take a ticket to Obirilovka? Asked Peter. She had quite forgotten where and why she was going, and only understood the question by a great effort. Yes, she said, giving him her purse, and hanging her little red handbag on her arm, she descended from the carriage. As she moved among the crowd toward the first-class waiting room, she gradually recalled all the details of her position and resolutions between which she vacillated, and again hope and despair, alternately chafing the old sores, lacerated the wound of her tortured and violently fluttering heart. Sitting on the star-shaped couch waiting for her train, she looked with repulsion at those who passed in and out. They were all objectionable to her. She thought now of how she would reach the station and would write him a note, and of what she would write, and of how he was now, without understanding her sufferings, complaining of his position to his mother, and of how she would enter the room and what she would say to him. And then she thought how happy life might still be, and how tormentingly she loved and hated him, and how dreadfully her heart was beating. All right, there we go. Anna is flipping out. Thinking a million thoughts at a time. And they're all about herself. I have your say about this chapter over on the subreddit. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.